This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're glad you're here with us. Today, we're going to continue a conversation we began exactly 1 week ago. Last Thursday, as we started our show, I proposed that we reconsider our collective definition of disaster.
What if we thought of weather events, like floods, fires, and quakes, not as disasters, but as shocks? Somewhat unpredictable, these shocks focus our attention and allow us to see the real disasters. Disasters that exist long before a storm gathers on the horizon.
Since that conversation, our nation has absorbed multiple shocks. The Caldor Fire forced thousands to evacuate the city of Lake Tahoe. Shock. Hurricane Ida came ashore in Louisiana and wiped out power to nearly 1 million people. Shock. And then just last night, deadly tornadoes and flooding in New York City caused by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. Shock. In New Orleans, Hurricane Ida is only the most recent shock to communities trying to manage multiple long-term disasters. A 24% poverty rate, the nation's highest maternal mortality rate, a long history of racial inequality in housing, schools, and health. And during the past 18 months, New Orleans has suffered some of the highest rates of COVID-19 infections and deaths. Just last month, Louisiana had its highest weekly total of COVID cases at any point in the pandemic. When shock after shock pummels a community, the result is not just inconvenience or stress, the result is trauma. And not just for individuals, but for families, for schools, for neighborhoods. Resilience after shock and disaster is possible, but only with the right tools. I mean, debris can be cleared, but only if we organize crews to clean it. Electricity can be restored, but only with teams of experts working around the clock to get the lights on. Homes and businesses can be rebuilt, but only with resources and assistance. In the same way, trauma can be addressed, but only if we pay attention and intervene. With me now is Dr. Denise Shervington, founder and CEO of the Institute for Women and Ethics Studies, a national nonprofit health organization in New Orleans. Thanks for being here, Dr. Shervington.
Hello, Melissa, and thank you so much. And your description of what's been happening is so on point.
Well, let me just ask, because I feel like I must, Dr. Shervington, inquire about you and about your staff at the Institute for Women and Ethnic Studies. Are all well and evacuated and dry and having power and light?
Everyone is well. Of course, the most important thing, no one was physically harmed. And for those who stayed, of course, there are those infrastructure problems, but they have found ways to cope. And so everybody that I know in New Orleans is okay.
And of course, that language that you just used about finding ways to cope. This is so much of the work that you and your organization have been doing now for going on 2 decades post-Katrina. Can you talk a little bit about some of the residual trauma effects of Hurricane Katrina and how you saw COVID-19 re-traumatize the city?
Yes. So when COVID-19 happened, you know, it was very close to Mardi Gras. People were at the height of enjoying themselves, the yearly ritual. And for many people, you talk about shock. No one knew. I actually was in New Orleans on Mardi Gras Day, hanging out, having fun. And, you know, we were only to learn a month later that this was the super spreader that took away so many of our beloved people. And with Hurricane Katrina again, talk about shock. People, we knew that there was a hurricane. It was somewhere in Florida in terms of the acute disaster of the hurricane. No one thought that a day later, the city was going to be flooded and everything that happened. The negativity around how we were treated as New Orleanians, the physical loss, and then just the having to cope, as you mentioned, shocks, acute shocks create trauma. And what happens when we experience trauma is the brain goes into survival mode. And unless we get the right kinds of support, the psychosocial supports that we need, a significant amount of us are going to develop trauma-based conditions. And so our work in New Orleans was really to lift up the importance of paying attention to the human condition of trauma. We actually eventually started collecting data to show how many children were experiencing the, you know, the result of going through a traumatic event without being acknowledged and supported. And we really focused on what we call psychoeducation, letting people know that when these kind of shocks happen, one, we are to expect that we are going to have emotional reactivity and that we need to understand how to manage.
I wanted to emphasize again your point about children, because I know one of the things we've discussed over the years is this language that somehow Katrina improved the schools, things got better, and your work around the trauma that children experienced so clearly challenges that by saying it doesn't, you know, test scores are less relevant than what our young people are experiencing in their hearts, in their minds, in their families, in their ability to be resilient. And I'm wondering again, given that Ida happened at the exact same time of year, right here at the beginning of a school year that was already after so much disruption related to COVID, what are some of your, what are some of the things people should be looking for in their children in this post-Ida moment?
So, you know, just to step back a little bit, there has been a language that's emerging that, you know, Ida was not as bad in terms of the physical damage as Katrina. I am positing that because it happened on the kind of bittersweet anniversary, sweet 16, of Katrina, that the mental fallout is perhaps going to be even worse. Because always in New Orleans, right under the surface, whenever there's heavy rain, whenever there's any threat of a storm, people become hyper-aroused. They become reawakened to the old traumas. For many, it has not fully resolved. So even though there might not be as much physical damage with the bittersweet 16th anniversary of Katrina, with COVID, I think that the mental health fallout is going to be very, very challenging, and in particular for children, because children oftentimes don't have the language to tell you how they're feeling inside. It's hard for them to put the emotional language that is necessary to get our attention. And what children do, they show you in their behaviors. They don't oftentimes tell you. And so what I think we're going to have to do, as we had begun doing because of COVID, really doing universal mental health screening for kids. Because unfortunately, what happens with our children, in particular children of color, when they're emotionally dysregulated and we see it in their behaviors, we tend to label them as bad and not sad as they oftentimes are.
Yeah, that sad-bad distinction is really clear to me in this moment. Talk about some of the behaviors, effects that we might see, for example, in school once schools are able to open again, once there's power. What should schools and families, communities, neighborhoods be looking for?
They should be looking for children who are either, I don't like the term, but I think this is the one we understand, the ones who seem to be acting out, whose behaviors are dysregulated, who might be, you know, more talkative than usual. And then on the other hand, children who are kind of a little more blanked out, who are not as engaged. Those are the children usually at the spectrum of trauma. And we need to be able to say to these kids, what has happened? Talk to me. Tell me what you're experiencing. oftentimes we tend to perceive these kids as bad. We think there's something wrong with them. And unfortunately, when we play into that negative narrative of our kids, some of them will end up in the criminal justice system when we can't recognize that these are kids who are very emotionally dysregulated because bad things, a series of bad things have been happening in their lives.
And of course, the teachers, the educators, the parents and communities themselves are also experiencing these shocks and this ongoing trauma. Do you have thoughts about the ways that, again, community resources, not just individuals on the couch, right, but communities can actually build some resilience buffers to assist one another in moments like this?
Yes, and thank you for highlighting the teachers. We just completed a survey in the COVID era, where teachers are showing a lot of signs and symptoms of trauma-based conditions, a lot of anxiety, a lot of sadness and depression. And so what we're going to have to do as a community, we have to stand up for each other. We have to let all of us know that we belong to each other. And it's okay, the message that it's okay to be feeling anxious, it's okay to be sad, it's okay to be angry. That message needs to be there so that we can let people know that they're having a normal reaction to very abnormal conditions and now another acute shock. And I think when as a community we can use that language together, we will know how to turn up for each other. The beautiful thing about New Orleans is that we already have the fabric for doing that. We always turn up to support and care for each other. However, being in a pandemic, one that's airborne, you can imagine the restrictions. And so within masking, being careful, hopefully getting vaccinated, we have to be present with each other. For example, at IWES, we have been doing virtual support groups during COVID where people can come and talk about how they're feeling in a safe space and where we share our stories with each other and we help each other learn how to cope with some of the negative emotional reactions that are normal that we're having.
Denise Shervington is founder and CEO of the Institute for Women and Ethics Studies, a national nonprofit health organization in New Orleans. Thanks so much, Dr. Shervington.
And thank you so much for caring about New Orleans always and Louisiana.
And if you or someone you know is experiencing stress, anxiety, or depression due to these natural or human-caused disasters and shocks, you can call the Disaster Distress Helpline. That number is 1-800-985-5990. Yeah, what you're hearing are the sounds of Louis Armstrong, jazz legend, national treasure, and native son of New Orleans. When Hurricane Ida made landfall on Sunday, it wiped away part of Armstrong's New Orleans history.
Historical significance behind this building that is no longer there, as this is the Karnofsky Music Store. This music store, we know, is affiliated with Louis Armstrong.
The Karnofsky Building is where Armstrong worked as a child for the Karnofsky family. They were the ones to encourage him to pursue music. And while we can never predict exactly what weather events will take from us, we can try to prepare. And in this instance, New Orleans was not prepared to lose the Karnofsky Building. I wanted to get a sense of how big a loss this was by talking with another native son of New Orleans, actor Wendell Pierce. Now, you probably know Pierce from Jack Ryan, or maybe his iconic Bunk Moreland role in The Wire. But if you're from New Orleans, what you truly remember is Wendell Pierce as Antoine Baptiste in HBO's Tremé.
Bruh, you'd have taken Jefferson Highway to magazine to get into town like I told you. It would have been cheaper.
You're killing me, dog. 28 on the meat.
I'm good for it, man. Just pick me up at 2 right here, baby. Take me home.
What I didn't expect to hear was how harrowing the experience of getting his own father, who's 96 years old, to safety during Ida was. Pierce had to watch the storm unfold from an ocean away due to his work.
I am in Athens, Greece right now working, shooting Jack Ryan. Saw the storm coming. We saw how urgent it was to evacuate. I didn't want to take any chances. My father was 80 during Katrina, and he's 96 now.
Wow.
He's at home still. We rebuilt the home that we rebuilt after Katrina, and he's under 24-hour care. So I coordinated two caretakers to go with him in his wheelchair accessible van and a follow car. And one of the caretakers, I said, bring your family, her husband and three children. And they started the trek to Houston. It took them 12 and a half hours. We had a medical emergency with one of the children on that Friday. I called ahead and said, we're going to be delayed because they have to have a medical procedure. And we'll get there Saturday morning. Got there Saturday night. That's how long it took.
Yeah.
When they arrived, their rooms were given away. It's now 1 o'clock in the morning. I asked to speak to the night manager or the night auditor, whatever his position is. I was on a speakerphone and he said he refused to speak to me. I said, I coordinated this entire trip. I've paid for this entire trip. How can you give the rooms away? And they gave the rooms away. So now I'm stuck. You know, we're in Houston. There's no rooms because everybody from New Orleans has evacuated there. My father has been in his wheelchair on the road for 12 and a half hours. I know I have to really take care of his health because it's fragile. We then immediately start getting on the phones, trying to find someplace to stay. And that night clerk then said, get out. You can't stay here, to my caretakers. And I said, we are trying to get rooms. You gave our rooms away. We called. He said, if you don't leave this lobby, I'm going to call security. And I was furious. So I told my caretakers, we were all getting a little upset then. I said, no, stay calm, go outside. He said he wants us to leave, and we still have to find rooms. So then they went outside in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. There, my father strapped into his wheelchair accessible van. The three kids are sleeping in the backseat of the other car. We're all on the telephones trying to find rooms in the middle of the night. It's now around 2 a.m. He then comes out and says, if you don't leave the parking lot, I'm going to call the police and have your vehicles towed. At this point, I'm furious. But I know the one thing I have to do is get my father somewhere so he can rest, so his health won't be endangered. I've been living all year in the Four Seasons in Budapest. I called them, literally, on the other side of the earth. They said, contact our hotel in Houston. We have one there. Contacted them. They gave us three rooms almost immediately. I said, leave that parking lot now. And I saw a wonderful story this morning of how this World War II veteran was saved in St. John Parish and how he was treated and taken out and the flag was given to him and all of that. And I thought about my father, how he was treated, another World War II veteran, as he arrived at 2 a.m. in Houston, like Mary and Joseph. There's no room in the inn. Forget you. And not only that, I will threaten you by calling authorities on you and now threaten you to get off my property.
You know, part of what's happened here is because the levees held, because there aren't spectacular images to show of our family members and our neighbors and our friends on the roofs of their home awaiting rescue, folks might think that, oh, well, all you had to do was evacuate. Like, how hard is that? And I feel like your story was such an important reminder that that question of just evacuate, just go, it's not that simple. And you're in a circumstance where you have resources. You're Wendell Pierce. You can make that phone call.
Yeah. You know, I thought about that. You know, I said, you know, and people, you know, people attacked me on social media saying, you know, who are you to call out some night clerk? And I'm like, it doesn't matter who I am. It's how people are treated. And I was only thinking about all the people that were treated that way that didn't have the resources. How many people didn't have the platform that I have on social media to expose the way that's probably how difficult the evacuation could be for so many people. 12 and a half hours on the road and to be greeted like that. But then just to have the difficulty of finding rooms and having the resources to now be in those rooms and going, are we going to stay for 2 days or 2 weeks or now 2 months?
which of course in so many ways brings us back to the experience 16 years ago. And particularly, you know, I think as I was realizing that your father was trying to get into a hotel in Houston, and we remember how so many people who were fleeing Katrina, who went to Houston, also did not find a warm welcome from the public policy there. Can you talk to us a little? Talk to us a little bit about the work that you've really been doing over the past 16 years. Maybe start with Pontchartrain Park.
I grew up in a wonderful neighborhood of Pontchartrain Park, which grew out of the civil rights movement. It was something ugly, actually, separate but equal, as we turned something ugly into something beautiful, and it became an incubator for Black talent. But it was a neighborhood that was very important. To the evolution of New Orleans and the civil rights movement. And it was totally destroyed during Katrina. And I put out a call to action to my generation, the Joshua generation, who have gone out in the world and become successful men and women, to come back and reestablish the neighborhood. And that's what we did. We rebuilt the neighborhood brick by brick, block by block, house by house. We reconstituted the Pontchartrain Park Neighborhood Association. Major League Baseball came to the community and rebuilt Barrow Stadium and made it an urban youth academy for their training program. Southern University at New Orleans has returned, and we put together our own development and did 40 homes. So leaving at this time, we were a little anxious to see that all the work that has been done over the 16 years would hold. And so far, so good when it comes to the levees.
So not everything survived, Ida. Do you want to talk a little bit about the destruction of this legendary jazz landmark?
You know, for years, we've been advocating, cultural leaders in New Orleans have been advocating for the city to really honor our iconic landmarks and iconic figures being the birthplace of jazz. Actually, jazz is a national park. Literally, the art form is a national park, just like the Grand Canyon. And most people in New Orleans don't even know that. And one of the landmarks was on the most famous block of jazz, where the creation of jazz, literally, you can stand on its mark. And that was the Karnofsky Grocery Store and Pawn Shop. Forgive the pronunciation, but the family was caretakers and employers of a little jazz icon and protege by the name of Louis Armstrong. It was where he worked. Next to that shop is hopefully, when I go back, it's still there, is the Eagle Saloon. And at the Eagle Saloon, the real founders of the music, the inventors of jazz, Jelly Roll Morton, Kid Ory, Buddy Bolden, they all played there. On the other side of that pawn shop and down that street, a couple of addresses is the Iroquois Theater, where when the music then started to be popularized, people really wanted to see it. It became one of the music halls at the very beginning of the onset of this great American iconic art form of jazz. And those three buildings are on the National Register of Historic Places. And I'm 58 years old in December, and they have never been renovated and never been restored and never held up to the level that they deserve. And one of them was lost in Ida. And I hope that this is a lesson that we'd learn as New Orleanians, as the leadership goes back, as cultural bearers, we must demand that these places be restored, be held up. They're on the National Register of Historic Places. They're the only reason they haven't been torn down is because they're protected by that designation. But yet we have procrastinated and have been apathetic about these icons. So we wonder if it's if that indifference is going to continue on. And it just broke my heart when I saw the images of it gone. And when you see that image, there was the one sort of nod to the historic nature of that plot of land was a mural of the only photograph of Buddy Bolden. An early band. Once in New Orleans, the saying said, right next to it, it was a beautiful mural. It was actually hopeful that they might even actually restore the buildings that it was honoring next to them. And now the images, that mural is destroyed too. It went down with the building. and it's gone, it's decayed, it's crumbled. But yet, there's still the saying next to it, once in New Orleans. The irony of that and the irony of that image should shake us to our core and realize that we have to bring back and honor the people that created this great, great American art form, jazz.
I so appreciate the trip that you're taking us on here, because I think, I mean, one of the great anxieties after Katrina was the concern that New Orleans would become the Disney version of New Orleans rather than the version that is true, that is out of the neighborhoods, right? Not just the French right. Quarter, not just the tourist spots, right? But the neighborhoods, right. The communities, where the music actually came from. Can you talk about Legacy Radio Station, WBOK, 1230 AM? I know you're one of the new owners there, and certainly investing in WBOK is definitely about a landmark of a different kind.
Yeah, WBOK is a legacy station, 70 years old. You know, it kind of gives a platform to those people that you were talking about, the real grassroots culture bearers. And they are the ones who sometimes never get an opportunity to speak their mind. And that's what WBOK does. It gives them a platform to go out there and speak their mind. And can you imagine this station being on air, you know, 70 years ago when people were saying there's a fish fry on Friday night at such and such a church, and you know Martin Luther King is going to be with Professor Dent at Dillard on Sunday. You know, it's that sort of thing that that I saw the radio station was being sold and came together with the group of investors to say, we can't let this station and a platform that is given to so many people in the community, an African American community specifically, go away. We have to give voice to the voiceless, and it's that same sort of attention that I hope we bring focus to and light to when it comes to our jazz landmarks and icons. A lot of them are in poor Black neighborhoods. You go to Central City in New Orleans, you know, that's where Buddy Bolden grew up and that's where Jelly Roll Morton was. And you understand the pathology of them walking right down the street to where that iconic Karnofsky grocery store fell, and where the Iroquois Theater was, and where the Eagle Saloon was. And so giving voice to the voiceless, it all ties together. As I advocate for the people in the communities, as they're coming back on WBOK, 1230 AM, New Orleans, what New Orleans is talking about. And
I love WBOK.
And also, you know, those are the same sort of people that created the music. You know, Jelly Roll Morton, you can go to where he lived in Central City and see there's a bar on every corner and a church on every other, right? So you saw that there's Saturday night and there's Sunday morning. It's all in one block, and you realize what were all the variables that made up the music and the sort of democratic nature of what jazz is all about, that you can be free and the freedom of an individual, but still honor form or law or structure. And that's the core changes. I mean, that's what jazz is. It is the manifestation of the American aesthetic. Freedom of the individual when he plays an improvised solo, and at the same time, honoring structure, the structure of the song and the music. And also, it's emblematic of America, what we want America to be, a nation of laws, that at the same time, you have your freedom within that. That the two can coexist. And that is the American aesthetic, and that is the aesthetic of what jazz is, and that is what our contribution to the cultural discussion of the world is. And that's why people come from around the world as jazz pilgrims, to see that culture. And we should honor that by having those landmarks restored and giving voice to the voiceless, because they were the voiceless at the time. And that's what WBOK is all about. So I am working here in Athens, Greece, and for another 10 days. I can't wait to get back home and begin rebuilding and recovering from this storm. And so I am a man of a multifaceted man, you know, of great, of multiple interests, and a man, hopefully, of Renaissance. I'm an artist, and see, that's the forum that I like to make the most impact, because while laws change behavior, thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that. Art can change people's hearts and minds. What thoughts are to the individual when you reflect on who you've been and who you hope to be as you lie awake at night, the forum of the artist is where we collectively come together and we decide on where we've been, where we hope to go. We decide on what our values are and then go out and act on them. So that's the forum where I like to play, where we collectively come together, decide what's important to us, what our values are, and then go out and act on them.
I have one last question for you, because anybody who can do an extended metaphor on American democracy and jazz, who makes reference to the Joshua generation, who can tell me about the investment work around housing and economic development in Pontchartrain Park. You running for office?
No, I'm not. But, you know, people always ask me that. I said, I'd rather be the kingmaker than the king. I find that, you know, it is a government of, for, and by the people. And I'm one of the people. So I always tell people, always assume that you are in office. You are the people. You are the government. So what you want to see, you know, make it happen. You know, create the world that you want to see, create the community that you want to see. You know, and that's the thing that you see in times like this, people reaching out in times of need, like Ida. And you realize that we have more in common than we have differences, and that we should utilize that.
Wendell Pierce, thank you so much for joining the Takeaway today.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hurricane Ida was brutal to Louisiana, but she battered Mississippi as well. Mississippi experienced flash floods and at least 2 deaths from the storm. And as of today, tens of thousands are still without power. The pandemic is also exacting a heavy toll on the state. Only 46% of Mississippi residents are fully vaccinated. And because the state already operates with a critical shortage of doctors and nurses, the pandemic has brought the state's healthcare system to the brink of collapse. Anita Lee is a reporter for the Sun-Herald based in Biloxi, Mississippi. Anita, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Anita, you did some reporting from the areas that were flooded by Ida. What did you see out there?
Well, some businesses had water in them. A lot of people had to evacuate their homes. We had 164 homes damaged, 42 destroyed. But it was encouraging to see that many people's homes were okay because they are elevated now. Hurricane Katrina was a storm that we had 16 years to the day earlier. And after that storm, the entire Mississippi coastline was destroyed in Katrina, and many people elevated their homes. So the water was under houses, and people were going in and out in rowboats and getting to their houses.
Yeah, it seems like Mississippi learned some really important structural and planning lessons from Katrina, and that that Ida hit Mississippi in some ways that were similar to how Katrina hit it, right? That it was a water event rather than, with Louisiana, you had the issue of the levees, which wasn't, what had happened in the context of Mississippi.
Right. The winds here were, for the most part, tropical storm strength. We might have had some hurricane gusts in Hancock County, which is the county neighboring Louisiana, but most of the damage we had here was from water.
Now, talk to me about the other disaster, which is underlying. So Katrina was a worse hurricane, but obviously there was no global pandemic going on 16 years ago. How has COVID-19 impacted the state in the broadest sense, and maybe also really in trying to prepare and now recover from Ida?
Well, it is very stressful. When you first think about it, and you're watching a storm out in the Gulf and you're thinking about evacuating, you don't normally have to think about a deadly virus, but you do in these circumstances. So all the shelters had masking and social distancing requirements, and we have a pretty serious pandemic here. We have the third highest level of COVID transmission in the country right now, and the COVID risk is high across the whole United States. But in that context, we're number three as far as number of cases per capita go right now. We're also the third least vaccinated state in the nation. So the feeling's pretty strong that we got some good COVID spread probably going during the pandemic. When I'm out reporting, I see very few people wearing masks here. People just don't seem to be taking this too seriously. There are some, but it's the minority who are wearing masks, and our transmission is high.
Yeah, I was just in Mississippi in July, just briefly driving through to New Orleans, and it was definitely the least masked state that we drove through. One more question here: with the power out, are kids in the state out of school again?
Yes, they were. I'm not sure what the situation is with schools today, but we do pride ourselves on getting our powers restored fairly quickly. So we had 136 customers without power on the Mississippi coast during and after the storm. That's in South Mississippi. And we had only 37,000 without power by yesterday afternoon. So the power is coming back here. We have a lot of Louisiana residents coming over here to get gas and filling up barrels with gas to take home because they could find no gas over there. So there's been some conflict with that on the border counties because people over here are afraid they won't have any gas. It's just a lot worse in Louisiana right now.
Thank you so much, Anita Lee, reporter for the Sun-Herald based in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Thank you.
Now on to New York City, where The Takeaway is produced. And even though I'm down here in North Carolina, this one hits hard for us. Late last night, as Hurricane Ida barreled into NYC, Mayor Bill de Blasio declared a state of emergency. The city saw record levels of rainfall, which led to flooding in the streets and subways, emergency flash flood warnings, a travel ban, and sadly, multiple fatalities. Part of New Jersey also saw torrential storms and tornadoes, along with flash flooding. With me now is the host of WNYC's Morning Edition, Michael Hill. Michael, how you doing?
Melissa, I'm okay. It was a rough commute this morning, I'll tell you that. I was coming up the Garden State Parkway in an Uber, and before we got on the highway, my driver had to dodge several abandoned cars at an intersection that flooded overnight. So it's been rough here all night long, but we are clear and calm this morning and sunny, and it looks like nothing ever happened until you start digging deep and look at the subways, look at the city, look at New Jersey and so forth. And again, consider that people died in flooded basements in New York City. One person died in a flooded car in Passaic, New Jersey. So there may be even more casualties to come.
It feels like this came out of nowhere. I mean, it felt like folks were really surprised. All my New York City friends were like, whoa, we thought there'd be rain, but we didn't expect this. Were you taken aback?
I think we all were. I think the forecast was for some really heavy rainfall overnight, gusty winds, even a gale warning that was in place until 6 o'clock last night. And we had flash flood warnings. What hit us from Ida was we got walloped. I mean, let's just face it. It was really bad. Areas here that where the grounds were saturated last week from Henri and so forth, and they had record rainfall last week. Well, even those records that were set last week were broken with this storm overnight. There are some places that got 2 to 3 to 4 inches within an hour or two. Newark Airport, for instance, had major issues. They were shut down all of the service there, and it was later restored this morning. But we're talking about, we got really whacked with this. And I don't even think that the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, the new governor, who's only been in office now for a little more than a week, she wasn't anticipating this either.
As I was watching the reports about the storm in New York, I kept thinking, I wonder if there's also a bit of a post-Sandy trauma in New York, and also, of course, the ongoing reality of COVID there.
There are comparisons to Sandy and the damage with Sandy for certain. We spoke to Governor Kathy Hochul this morning about that, and she was talking about the climate resiliency and being prepared and so forth. And this is a once in a 500-year or 1,000-year storm. But even given that, my question was, okay, knowing that kind of reality and we're into a different phase of climate change and so forth, shouldn't we have been a little bit more prepared even for something like this when you say it's going to happen once every 500 years or 1,000 years? Is that, okay, we're in this pattern now where these really awful things are happening with weather when you consider what's taking place out west with the brush fires and so forth and the storms and one storm after the other in the Atlantic and so forth. And we're going to get whacked here on the East Coast more and more and probably with more regularity as well.
This hurricane season's been pretty brutal.
It has been. And we're already at the I-named storms, and we haven't even reached the peak of the season yet, which is for the Atlantic hurricane season is the first or the second week in September, September 10th. And here we are, you know, these storms are coming one right after the other. It looks like, you know, you're dealing with the aftermath of Ida, and then you look out there, and there's another named storm, Julian. And the water out there, as the National Weather Service and NOAA and so forth describe, the water is really warm.
So we've been talking about how to prepare for disaster, not just with your go bag, but really prepare with your neighbors. Any thoughts about how New Yorkers can make sure that they are sticking close to each other while staying distant from each other?
You know, I go back to what the experience I had with retired Lieutenant General Honore in New Orleans after Katrina, and just mentions that you look in on your neighbors, do things that are smart. You certainly prepare for yourself, but you also check in on loved ones and neighbors to make sure that the whole community is prepared, because what takes place next door does have an impact on you. And there's a lot of that kind of consideration that Lieutenant General Russell Honore used to talk about, and talked about others being prepared individually, personally, but community as well.
Oh, love Honore. WNYC's Morning Edition, Michael Hill. Thanks for joining us.
Most welcome.
Sixteen years ago, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, officials at the Orleans Parish Prison abandoned the people in their custody. Prisoners were left locked, caged, and without power as sewage-tainted floodwaters began to fill prison cells. They had no food or water, some of them up to 4 days without it. As Hurricane Ida approached, multiple prisoners' rights organizations put the Orleans Parish prison officials on notice that this time they would raise the alarm in both social and traditional media if prisoners were once again abandoned. Gina Womack is the co-founder and executive director of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, or as we call it, FLIC. And she joins us to discuss the most vulnerable of incarcerated populations, children. Welcome, Gina.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So let's talk first about the system of so-called juvenile justice or childhood incarceration in Louisiana, even before storms or outside of storms. What is it like? What's happening in the state?
Yeah, ironically, this month is going to mark our 20th anniversary. So when I started this organization, working with a partner organization, we were looking at the conditions of confinement for the children who were locked in our state's custody. And to say the least, you know, conditions were really dismal. Fast forward 20 years later, you know, we passed the Juvenile Justice Reform Act in 2003. We're still seeing a lot of the same issues that we saw before. While many things have changed, like the number of young people who are actually incarcerated, it's kind of unfortunate that we still have to exist to support parents, to fight for services and supports for their children who need them. So some things have changed, but really little has changed. And so we're still concerned about if our state is working to set our children up for success.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ida moment. I know that young people were evacuated from the Bridge City Youth Center to other facilities, but I'm wondering if you know where they are, what their conditions are, if their families were told about where they were going.
Yes, so that is one thing that has changed. So the young people have been evacuated. Speaking to some families, what their concerns are is that while they know their young person has been evacuated, they don't know exactly where they are. They are speaking, are able to speak to their children only through third party process. So their young people are just not able to pick up the phones and contact their parents. And so that's a grave concern. As you can imagine, trying to evacuate without your children is really very stressful and traumatic for parents.
Can we talk about COVID-19? Clearly, in adult prisons, the question of COVID-19, the infection rate, the death rate, in what we might now think of as that kind of first year, year and a half of the pandemic, was a central social justice issue. But, you know, many people weren't talking about incarcerated young people or confined young people because we didn't think that COVID-19 had these big effects on young people. But now we know that it does. What do you know about COVID-19 in Louisiana? As youth detention centers?
Yes. I mean, and that's just the crazy thing about, you know, COVID. I mean, we didn't know a lot about it. So to me, I don't know why we would have taken any chances with young people as well. So when COVID hit and the governor here called for and allowed for older folks that are incarcerated to be transferred out, that wasn't the case for our young people. And so that was a grave concern for us as, and families as well, because the order should have come down and young people should have been able to return home safely to their families, right? So their families could care for them. And that wasn't the case.
So I see that local reporting in New Orleans is already talking about the way that Ida and particularly the power outage is going to cause even more backlogs in the court system. As someone who's doing, again, criminal justice work, do you have a solution for addressing these or sets of solutions for addressing these, you know, concerns about COVID-related court delays and now Ida-related court delays?
Good question. And, you know, again, we were hoping that we would be able to reform this system in 3 years. And the law that we put in place, the Juvenile Justice Reform Act of 2003, that was to look and make sure we were divesting from incarceration and putting more time and money into services on the front end, right? So we maintain, if we had followed the blueprint of the Reform Act in 2003, we would have less and less young people locked in prison and at home with their families in their communities and having to deal with COVID and Ida in such a manner of having kids locked in cages wouldn't necessarily be on the front end, right? And so that's the grave concern for us. That, again, are we protecting our young people? And so thinking about the solutions are community-based programs that we've been talking about for the last 20 and even longer, right? We know that children are better served at home in their communities with people who love and care for them.
Gina, one last question. There was a school shooting here in my community in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, just yesterday. And I spent several hours with parents and families of the local high school. One student shot and killed another student in school. And as I sat and talked with the parents, we're only in our second week of classes, and they were telling me lots of stories about fights, about guns, some that were happening in school, some that were happening at home. And I have to say, to a parent, all of them were saying, we knew it. We knew that our kids going back after a year and a half of being out of school, out of class, and they've just sent them back and haven't even hardly really talked about what they were experiencing over the past year and a half. You've been doing this work for 20 years. Yesterday in my community, we'd lost two children. We lost both the child who was killed and undoubtedly the child who did the shooting. Do you have words for communities that are grieving like mine is right now about how we can think about preventing this kind of loss at the front end?
I'm so sorry to hear and learn of the loss. I saw the news later last night, and it continues to pain me to think about, you know, when, you know, children, communities are suffering due to COVID and the many disasters that we're having to deal with. And so you would think that we would have opportunities to have more counselors in schools, taking time to really have conversations. Again, you know, preventing these things prior to, right? And if we were going to send young people back to school, having services in circles and counselors in our communities that are able to prepare young people and talk about what's happening. How are they feeling? How are they coping? I mean, families are losing jobs. They're losing homes. They're being evicted. I talked to one family trying to evacuate. They were living in their car. You know, we're hurting. The poverty rate here in Louisiana and New Orleans is still very high. And families need to be able to be supported. And so forward thinking about what our young people are experiencing at this moment is crucial. And up and until, again, that we are forward thinking and we're keeping our children close to our hearts and understanding what they need and listening to families and young people, I don't see how we're going to be able to really move forward.
Gina Womack is the co-founder and executive director of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, or FLIC. Thank you for joining us, Gina, and we're sending our thoughts to you and to your community who are continuing to face the aftermath of Ida.
Thank you, Melissa, and we're sending the same to your community and to children across this country.
Okay, y'all, that's the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Our stories today sure did cross the map. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.